Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health policy, health innovation, and technology, and the top thought leaders who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Susanna Fox, former Chief Technology Officer at the Department of Health and Human Services and expert on how Americans utilize the internet and social media to gain knowledge about their health. She talks about how digital health is transforming the healthcare experience. Lori Robertson also checks in, the managing editor of FactCheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter at CHC Radio. We love hearing from you. And you can also find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, or ask Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Susanna Fox on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Susanna Fox, leading health industry researcher with a special focus on health consumers and the internet. She previously served as Chief Technology Officer at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services under President Obama. Prior to that, she spent 14 years at Pew Research studying the impact of internet technology on consumers and healthcare. Ms. Fox also served as entrepreneur in residence at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. She earned her BA in anthropology at Wesleyan University, right here in our backyard. Susanna, welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you.
Obviously, we're calling you from the home of Wesleyan University at WESU. I'm sure you're familiar with. Go Wes!
Yay!
You've been charting the behaviors of American consumers in their interface with the internet for nearly two decades, with a special focus in on how they access health information. During that time, access to the internet has become ubiquitous. You say that at no other time in history have we been able to communicate across the world in an instant with anyone who has knowledge or experience to share. And I'm just wondering if you could tell our listeners what you've learned.
If you think back, even just, 20 years ago, if you had a question, you were limited to asking your friends and family, going to the library. You might be able to research a health question in a medical library. Now that's really blown open. People have access to medical journal articles in every language. There's so much information that has been digitized. And even more importantly, people have access to each other, meaning they can put a question out on the network, whether it's on social media or even just using email, and they can get answers. But so often people are able to connect with other people who share the same health condition, who are at the same life stage, who can answer their question in what I like to call a just-in-time someone like you, someone who knows exactly what you're going through and can help you at that time.
Well, Susanna, when you last joined us, you were serving as the Chief Technology Officer at HHS. And it was created to foster more rapid adoption of digital technologies in healthcare, specifically to facilitate the speed of sharing health data and to give people access to their own health records. I think we'd all agree it's been a challenge for the health industry to provide what they think patients will want. At the same time, patients seem to be very interested in healthcare apps, which might not have anything to do with what the traditional health industry is providing. How might healthcare get better at actually devising solutions that patients want to use?
I love this question because it calls on the history of what we have been trying to create at the federal government level and at the industry level, and that is to open up the data warehouses. And big organizations, including the federal government, might be forgiven for getting really excited at the beginning of the data revolution to open up the warehouses that we already had. It did feel really different to allow people to have access even to just a small stream of data. But, consumers aren't really sure what to do with the information. For example, I'm still a fan of Blue Button, which was a revolutionary program started in the Obama administration, first at the VA and now for Medicare beneficiaries.
Right.
They're actually opening it up to an API so that veterans and Medicare beneficiaries can not only access the information in their health record, but direct it to an app of their choice. And that's where I'm starting to see a bridge to the future, a bridge to where consumers are already using health apps, and so much of health happens outside the clinic. So what we need to do is figure out a way to marry the streams of data, the stream of data that comes from the clinical encounter, as well as the stream of data that a consumer might be generating with their wearables, or even better, what is the data that could help someone navigate the grocery store in a smarter way to make better choices about their food? Or how can people sleep better at night? That's actually where health really lives.
That's very fascinating. When you, Margaret, when Susanna was talking about liberating data, I think about Todd Park, who was part of that sort of revolution along with you and others.
Right.
But as an anthropologist by training, you're fascinated with the human behavior in society. And one of those demographics you've been most focusing on is the youth population, the so-called digital natives. And I think it's fair to say that many adults would love to have greater insight into what's going on in the minds of their teenagers. And you've really taken a deep dive into this group, as they're clearly the most agile navigators of this space. And you recently did a study for Hope Lab, a company designing digital tools to help facilitate healthy behaviors. And your report yielded some fascinating insights. And tell us more about what you've learned.
Well, we went into this wanting to make space for the teens and young adults themselves to tell us in their own words what they think. So we designed it to be a traditional survey where we asked some questions, you know, statistical, numerical data, and we left plenty of space for open-end responses. One of the most important findings is that there really is a significant existing market for digital health tools in this age group. 9 in 10 14 to 22-year-olds have looked online for health information. Two-thirds of teens and young adults have used mobile apps related to health, and they're mostly focused on things like fitness, but there are a lot of them who are using health apps to track sleep and meditation. The other thing that I was surprised by is that 6 in 10 teens and young adults say they have read or listened to or watched other people share about their health experiences. And they're talking about podcasts, they're talking about watching TED Talks or YouTube videos. Video especially emerged in the open-ended questions as a huge potential for health education among teens and young adults.
Well, you know, Susanna, it's not surprising, really, given the amount of time the average American teen spends engaged with their smartphones. And there's been a lot of high-profile stories about screen time not being good for kids in the long run, some studies that have linked a rise in anxiety and other mental health conditions to digital exposure. But I was really struck by one of your findings in particular, that teens are starting to very wisely, sensibly use online platforms to help them deal with real behavioral health issues. Tell us a little more about how young people are using digital tools to help them address, you know, very important and significant personal challenges in a way that they couldn't before, and potential of this to democratize in some ways access to help that hasn't been there for kids who face a lot of barriers to getting the help they need.
In a lot of ways, the internet and a teenager's phone can be a lifeline as they navigate adolescence and young adulthood. The two groups who are in particular need of support when it comes to emotional well-being are teenage girls and young women. They are much more likely than males their age to go online for information about anxiety or depression. The other group is LGBTQ youth. Three out of four say they've looked online for information about depression, compared to 32% of straight cisgender youth. But again, in talking with young people directly and giving them space to tell us, so when you're feeling low, do you go online or do you avoid going online? Do you use social media? If you do, how do you use it? And what emerged in their answers, young people are not helpless pawns of social media. A lot of them are actively curating their social media feeds to get inspiration, to find humor and emotional support. other people recognize that it's not a good idea for them to go online when they're feeling sad. And so they self-regulate and they stay away from social media. Yeah. There are people who say, I know that social media makes me feel worse, but I can't stop myself. And it's these vulnerable youth that we need to be concerned about, but we need to make sure that we are approaching this with the understanding that young people's experience of social media is nuanced.
We're speaking today with Susanna Fox, leading health industry researcher on health consumers and the internet. She served as chief technology officer at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And Susanna, you wrote recently about something that we're very interested in our practice. We're one of the early participants in the All of Us Precision Medicine Initiative. You've noted the rise of biocitizens, and we recently had Larry Smarr on, who was probably the most measured man in the world. And there seems to be this growing tide of consumers who are gaining deeper insight into their own health through accessing their personal genome, as well as other health information from wearables. And you say it's spurring a whole new trend in DIY, do-it-yourself healthcare, and signals another dramatic shift in consumer behavior. If you could tell our listeners more about this emerging trend.
Well, I've always been interested in going out to the edges of any field to see what the hackers and the cowboys are doing. And I got to say, Larry Smarr is in that category.
He certainly is.
and in healthcare, people who live on the edge of healthcare are often people living with rare conditions because they so often have to engage in experimental treatments, which really looks like DIY medicine. And one trend that I noticed, because I started meeting people who were not only experimenting with tracking data, but they were also making or adapting physical objects, assistive devices, like a writing tool for someone with low dexterity, you know, hacking a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. And I saw how the maker movement is running parallel to both the empowered patient movement and the biohacker movement. So what I see is this really interesting confluence where manufacturing tools and the tools of scientific discovery are becoming cheaper. And we're seeing more and more people experimenting, creating a DIY lab. You know, it's this access to the personal genome, to access to crowdsourcing, to experiment in ways that we didn't really have 20 years ago. And what I'm interested to see is how this is spreading into the more mainstream population. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because there are a lot of people who have health mysteries that they would like to solve. And it's not just people who have access to the highest end tools like Larry. I personally think it's exciting, mm-hmm. but it's also intimidating mm-hmm. because there's potential for mischief. And my rubric, my ethos in general is to open up access to the information, data, and tools that people need to solve problems. And I hope that it doesn't result in creating problems.
Well, Susanna, we've talked about the teens and we've talked about the tech-savvy people, but coming in from the edges to a incredibly large, going to grow population. We think about the older population and the older of the older population, you know, the 85 plus who are increasingly not living in nursing homes. And there's a whole incredibly exciting focus on really supporting that life and providing the opportunity not to get on a keyboard, but with their voice, get support in their own home for doing some of their own activities of daily living, for monitoring, for connecting with other people. What are you excited about with this group? What are you hearing from friends who may be caring for elderly parents across the country or people that you've come across who are focused on this particular age group that we know is only going to grow?
It certainly is only going to grow. My personal observation, having been a caregiver, and my observation based on research, is that caring for a loved one, especially an older adult, is still a very hands-on activity. One aspect of caregiving that I turned up in my research is that caregivers are challenged by the complicated schedule of medications that their loved one is on. You know, we have all these wonderful advancements in the pharmaceutical world, but how are we asking people who maybe have some forgetfulness, who maybe have some dexterity problems, to remember to take these tiny pills in the right order. And so I think that's a place where technology can really be helpful. The other place that I see is very important is that elders and caregivers are two groups that are challenged by feeling isolated.
Right, absolutely.
And that's, again, something that technology can help with. There's a lot that can be done with telepresence. There's a lot that can be done in terms of online support groups. I'm really interested in the connections between peers. You don't have to leave your loved one to go to an online support group to get that crucial advice or word of encouragement that you might need. Now, the Consumer Electronics Show always has amazing gadgets on display, and I love seeing what people come up with in terms of, you know, the spying that you can do on loved ones, and, you know, smart toilets and other gadgets like that. But really, I am a big believer in listening to the people who are, frankly, listening to the people who are doing the wiping and the swabbing.
Yeah.
And asking them, what do they need? And I don't know that it's going to be that they need more surveillance and smart toilets. I think they're going to need more help with the medication management.
Yep, very practical.
Susanna, you're an anthropologist and researcher, and I think our listeners have heard today you're a forward-thinking visionary. And, you know, we just had Noelle La Charotte on the show, and she's done a lot on voice applications in healthcare. And I'm wondering what your thought is about voice and what's happening in that realm. The keyboard's a little clunky. Is there any breakdown by age of people who are thinking about voice applications, or do you think that's a whole new frontier for us? There may be a whole new interface for us.
I think voice activation is a wonderful forward step. I think that it's an example of assistive technology for people living with disability that is going to move into the mainstream. And it really can't move fast enough. And, you know, among the hackers and the cowboys of healthcare, I also put in that category people living with disability.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
They make a way out of no way.
Yeah. Yep.
And so what we're seeing in terms of, you know, the assistive technology that grew from, you know, screen readers and the ability to take dictation, essentially. I will say that my husband recently had hand surgery, and so is unfortunately living this where he has to actually dictate every memo and every email. And I wouldn't say he's happy with the technology that he's being offered right now. So we still have a long way to go. But in terms of telehealth and telepresence, one of the findings of the Hope Lab and Wellbeing Trust survey of the teens and young adults gives a little bit of an indication of a possible future. 20% of that age group say they have already interacted with a clinician online, whether it was via text, mm-hmm. via video. So this is an age group that is very ready for telemedicine. And I'm intrigued to see how that grows, because we really need to find a way to revolutionize access to primary care and to mental health professionals. I think the future of clinical care is home-based more than we can even imagine right now. And again, I'll put in a plug for peer-to-peer healthcare, that there's this invisible network that surrounds us of people who could give us advice. If only they knew what question we were struggling with. There might be people in your father's network who are waiting to help, but they just haven't found a way in yet.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it still comes back to humanity. Mm. I think most people do want to help and will provide that just-in-time advice if we give them the chance. So as the clinic moves more into the home, how can we tap into that invisible network that surrounds us to stay healthy?
We've been speaking today with Susanna Fox, leading health industry researcher on health consumers and the internet. You can learn more about her research by going to susannafox.com or follow her on Twitter @SusannaFox. Susanna, thank you for your ongoing and important research in this emerging sector of healthcare, for your kindness and humanitarianism, and for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
It was my pleasure.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
In our latest quarterly update of Trump's numbers, we looked at various statistical measures under Trump's presidency. For health insurance coverage, the number of people lacking health insurance has barely changed since Trump took office, but millions are expected to drop or lose coverage this year and in subsequent years. The most recent report from the National Health Interview Survey estimates that 28.5 million people were uninsured during the first 6 months of 2018. That's about 100,000 fewer than in 2016. Only 8.8% of the population lacked health coverage during that time, down from 9% during Obama's last year. That's a reversal of the trend in Trump's first year, when the number who lacked coverage rose by 700,000. Trump failed to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, as he promised to do. But in December 2017, he signed a tax bill that will end the ACA's tax penalty for people who fail to obtain coverage. That took effect this year. Earlier, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimated that the end of the mandate penalty will cause 4 million people to lose or drop coverage this year, rising to 12 million 2 years later and 13 million in 2025. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. While more than 20 million Americans have gained coverage under the Affordable Care Act, some 30 million remain uninsured, and many of these are either immigrants or without the resources to purchase coverage. While most can access primary health care in the nation's community health centers and safety net hospitals, many more with complex conditions simply can't afford access to specialty care. Entrepreneur Jayanth Komarnani decided to create a virtual way to bypass the system and founded the Human Diagnosis Project, a network of volunteer specialists offering virtual consults for the neediest patients.
The Human Diagnosis Project is an online system built by the world's doctors to understand the best steps to help any patient. In the process of developing the Human Diagnosis Project, we realized that there is an opportunity to develop a system that can ultimately help solve the problem for those people who won't have access to specialty care.
Dr. Shantanu Nundy is director of the Human Diagnosis Project. He's a frontline primary care provider in a safety net clinic who saw the opportunity to provide specialty care in a cost-effective way.
The way the system works is safety net providers like myself can freely exchange electronic consultations with volunteer specialists from around the country so that the expertise that those specialists have that our uninsured patients currently can't have access to becomes available.
It's estimated that roughly 35% of specialist visits can be done virtually. The Human Diagnosis Project offers an opportunity to create real savings in the healthcare system.
So there is a very real and large portion of situations in which providing an electronic perspective on that given problem will actually solve that problem for many patients.
Online portal linking safety net providers serving underserved populations to specialty care expertise, improving outcomes for millions of uninsured and vulnerable patients. Now that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.